Today is Thursday, May 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up.
The main argument that the Trump administration is making is that the equipment that allow the Chinese government to spy on other countries where this equipment is installed.
That's VOA Beijing Bureau Chief Bill Ide. We'll have more on this story coming up. Also ahead, U.S. President Donald Trump will announce his long-awaited proposal on immigration this afternoon. And Houthi rebels have moved their military forces away from the critical Red Sea port of Hodeida. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. President Donald Trump is scheduled to announce his long-awaited proposal on immigration this afternoon, a plan that aims to shift the immigration approval process away from one that prioritizes family ties and humanitarian needs. In a briefing to reporters ahead of Trump's scheduled afternoon remarks at the White House Rose Garden, a senior administration official said the plan will favor immigrants with advanced education and skills, saying it is a competitiveness issue. Well, for more on President Trump's immigration proposal, joining me by telephone is VOA's Victoria Mackey. Thank you so much for joining me, Victoria.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, Victoria, what are some of the highlights of the plan?
So we're still short on details, and I think I don't know to what extent the president's actually going to get around to announcing more specifics. So far, the gist is exactly what you mentioned. It is a shift in the U.S. immigration system towards a more work-based approach rather than a family-based approach. Right now, more than half of new green card holders every year to the U.S. Have some sort of family relation to people who have already immigrated to the U.S. So this would be what we've heard so far from the White House is this would sort of swap that. We would have more than half of the visas, the immigrant visas every year would be for kind of work-based. And even more specifically towards, you know, highly educated, you know, more professional positions.
Do you think the Democrats will support this?
You know, I don't know that. I don't know. And I've been talking with a fair number of both immigration lawyers, folks on the Hill, hearing from them over the last couple of days. This plan doesn't seem to have a lot of traction. Immigration law in the U.S. has been very, very difficult to change. It is very complicated, and especially with the lack of specifics that we have right now, there doesn't seem to be a lot of traction for this, for so far what the White House is proposing.
Based on your sources, what do you think is going to be the response of people?
It's hard to say in terms of, again, once we have more details, you know, in a few hours, it'll be easier to suss out what the specific reactions might be. I don't know that there's going to be a lot based on what we have so far. The White House isn't proposing anything super new, super, revolutionary. This isn't a giant sweeping change. I mean, it doesn't even address certain areas that people are really looking for, like deferred action, you know, the so-called dreamers. It doesn't even touch on that from what we understand. So far it's sort of a bit of a dud.
Yeah, I was just getting that same type of reaction, especially from the other party. The Democrats don't seem to say that it's not even addressing, like you mentioned, the DACA program. So then what are people saying that is really, what is the president's goal in doing this at this time?
You know, the president has really focused in the last two and a half years that he's been, running in office. There have been a lot of changes to the immigration program in the U.S., especially lately with asylum and refugees. So, you know, a lot of that has focused on what is the president and the White House are trying to maybe take away from the immigration program. And it seems like this is reframing that and maybe putting a more proactive spin on it. Whether that works, I don't know. I'm not sure that they're really going to get what they wanted out of this. There's no legislation. This, you know, Congress really has the ultimate, you know, role in determining new laws. And so the White House can kind of say, you know, whatever it wants about what it would like to see change in the immigration program, but ultimately it's not really up to the president in a lot of ways.
Okay, well, thank you so much for your insight. That's VOA's Victoria Mackey on the phone with me. Well, U.S. officials have effectively banned a Chinese telecom titan, Huawei, from building next-generation 5G mobile networks in the U.S. and are warning other countries about the company's national security risks. Yesterday, U.S. President Donald Trump signed an executive order that bars American companies from using telecommunications equipment that is made by companies that pose a national security risk. The order, which declares a national emergency, is the first step toward formalizing a ban on doing business with Huawei. For its part, however, Huawei has shown no signs of backing down and has been making extraordinary pledges to win over its critics and dispel allegations that it is a security threat. The company says it will quit its business if forced to spy on its customers, and now its company chair, Ling Hua, has offered to sign a no-spy agreement as well. Well, International Edition Steve Miller spoke with VOA Beijing Bureau Chief Bill Ide about the executive order.
So this executive order is coming down as nations begin developing and rolling out 5G mobile networks. What exactly is their underlying concern by the Trump administration as it regards to Huawei?
Well, Huawei has long been a concern of the U.S. government. It's long been on its radar. But the main argument that the Trump administration is making is that the equipment that Huawei builds, which is going to be key in kind of building this backbone of this new infrastructure for 5G, could allow for spying, allow the Chinese government to spy on other countries where this equipment is installed. Huawei has repeatedly denied that, you know, this is possible, that it would do this, that it would allow that to happen. But this is the message that the Trump administration has been really working on over the past year, and it's kind of culminated now with this executive order. Really, the order itself formalizes what already a ban that was already, you know, essentially in place, that the carriers in the U.S. are not going to work together with Huawei to build up their 5G networks.
So how does this executive order and the notion that U.S. carriers aren't going to work with a company like Huawei to build their 5G networks, how does this EO affect them?
Well, essentially, it's not going to have any effect on them because they're already not working with Huawei. They're working with the other two companies, Ericsson or Nokia, or the other two big companies out there that can build or are capable of building the equipment that's needed for these 5G networks. So it's not going to really change anything from that perspective. There is an interesting facet to this, though, that in addition to kind of formalizing this ban, the Commerce Department has listed 70 entities that are affiliated with Huawei, and this is going to impact their access to U.S. technology, that there's now going to be more scrutiny of their purchase of equipment than, you know, parts that would then be used or could be used in this equipment. So that, I think, is going to be a significant thing. At this point, I'm not very clear on how much Huawei relies on U.S. parts to build its equipment that's used in 5G networks. Will this be similar to the case that we saw with ZTE when the U.S. government banned or had a tightened scrutiny on their purchase of, this is another Chinese telecom company, when the U.S. government tightened controls on their purchase of U.S. products? That had a huge impact, especially when it comes to semiconductor chips. So the company really took a serious spill after that. So whether or not this will impact Huawei in different ways is still unclear.
You also mentioned that Huawei said that there's no way it would ever be using its technology to conduct spying operations in the United States or elsewhere. How is the company responding to those kinds of specific allegations to protect its global business?
We recently had a chance to go visit Huawei's headquarters in the southern city of Shenzhen. Shenzhen has kind of been at the forefront of China's opening up to the global economy over the past three decades or more. And when we visited there, you know, one of the things that they were stressing was that the company itself has taken, you know, huge measures to protect the privacy and the data of its customers. there's a message that has been kind of slowly coming out, but has really intensified in recent weeks and even on Tuesday, and that's that they're staking their entire business on this. They're saying that if they're violating customers' security, then their business has nowhere to go, and they'll be out of business. The company founder, Ren Zhengfei, a former military engineer, has said that if any country has asked Huawei to spy or they're forced to spy, that they would rather just get out of business than do that. Now, how one pulls that off is another question. But on Tuesday, the chairman, Liang Hua, also made remarks while he was visiting Britain, and which is another key area where Huawei is trying to roll out its 5G networks. And while he was there, he said that Huawei is willing also now to sign what he called no spy, no backdoor agreements, basically pledge to not do this in writing.
That was VOA International Edition's Steve Miller speaking with VOA Beijing Bureau Chief Bill Ide. Among the top stories in the world, Spain's decision to withdraw a frigate assigned to a U.S. Navy task force ordered into the Persian Gulf this week reflects persistent fears of Spanish socialists about getting involved in a possible war with Iran. U.S. and European law enforcement agencies say they have dismantled a global cybercrime network that used malicious software to steal an estimated $100 million from businesses around the world. And Sudan's ruling military council suspends talks with civilian protest leaders on a transitional government after at least 8 people were wounded in an apparent clash with security forces in Khartoum yesterday. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition. While the UN envoy for Yemen confirmed yesterday that Houthi rebels had moved their military forces away from the critical Red Sea port of Hodeidah in a positive first step toward easing hostilities in the country's 4-year-long civil war. The redeployment, which was agreed to at intra-Yemeni talks in Stockholm in December, had been repeatedly delayed, but the first phase was finally put in motion between Saturday and Tuesday. The pullback is significant as Hodeidah port has been a flashpoint in the conflict. Hodeidah is the main point of entry for all commercial and aid supplies entering the country. Yemen imports 90% of its food. While North Korea accused the U.S. of robbery earlier this week and demanded the immediate return of a cargo ship seized for allegedly violating international sanctions. In a statement in the official Korean Central News Agency, North Korea's foreign ministry warned of unspecified consequences in response to the U.S. seizure of the vessel. The KCNA statement claimed the seizure violates the 2018 agreement between U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un to improve bilateral relations. The U.S. announced last week it had seized the Wise Honest, which was originally detained in April 2018 by Indonesian authorities. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Neil Watts about the situation. Watts served as the marine expert on the UN panel of experts for North Korea for 5 years up until 2018.
North Korea accused the United States of robbery Tuesday and demanded the immediate return of a cargo ship seized for allegedly violating international sanctions. In a statement in the official Korean Central News Agency, North Korea's foreign ministry warned of unspecified consequences in response to the U.S. seizure of the Wise Honest. KCNA statement claimed the seizure violates the 2018 agreement between U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un to improve bilateral relations. The United States announced last week that it had seized the ship, which was originally detained in April of last year by Indonesian authorities. U.S. officials say the 17,000-ton vessel, North Korea's second-largest cargo ship, had been used to export North Korean coal in violation of international sanctions. That's the first time U.S. officials had seized a North Korean vessel. We welcome to VOA Asia Neil Watts. He served as the maritime expert on the UN panel of experts for North Korea for 5 years until last year. Neil, welcome. Are there any valid grounds on which Pyongyang can claim that their ship was robbed?
I don't think so. I think the resolutions are quite clear in terms of if you're involved in ship-to-ship transfers or activities prohibited by the resolutions, that your vessel could be subject to seizure by member states. And the resolutions provide for that and give member states a mandate to do so. I think that the seizure of the Wise Honest sends a signal that, in particular, the U.S. is serious about the enforcement of sanctions, and particularly under the maximum pressure campaign. I've been saying for a long time that a lot of vessels that have been identified as carrying out prohibited activity have continued their activities without any recourse, except for the fact that they were named and shamed in panel of experts reports. And I think if there is a tighter control over the movement of these ships, such as impounding them or seizing them, thus far, only three countries have done this. The first was, in fact, Mexico with the Muda bomb, which was seized and subsequently sold for scrap. Then the South Koreans have seized at least four vessels that I know of, and they've impounded them, in fact, under the resolutions. And these are still with South Korea. And so this ship seized by the U.S. makes them only the third country to have done so. So many countries are identifying or photographing these vessels that are breaking the sanctions. But thus far, only three have done anything about it.
The United Nations can bring up what is wrong, but it cannot do anything as far as seizing a ship is concerned.
No, all the UN can do is through the panel of experts and the 17-18 committee is to alert member states of illicit activity. And it is up to the member states, who are the eyes, ears, and teeth of the United Nations, to take the appropriate action.
How is North Korea getting around these sanctions?
It's getting around the sanctions through various means. The primary means right now is through ship-to-ship transfers. Apparently, the Wise Honest was destined to make a transfer to another ship via ship-to-ship transfer nearby Bulik in Indonesia. But, of course, this did not happen. So we're not sure which ship it was going to go to. But there's no doubt that Korea is managing to export its coal either through transshipment or by ship-to-ship transfers through complicit companies who are quite aware that it is prohibited by the resolutions.
That was Neil Watts, a former marine expert for the United Nations on North Korea. He spoke with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. This is VOA's International Edition.
Host Carol Castiel interviews Nancy Lindborg, president of the United States Institute of Peace, to discuss USIP's mission, research regarding a strategy to prevent the spread of extremism around the world, and the vital role of women in the successful conflict resolution negotiations. Listen this Saturday and Sunday to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.
The British medical charity Wellcome Trust is kicking off a new drive to reduce the deaths and disabilities caused by bites from poisonous snakes. Tens of thousands of people around the world are killed by snake bites each year, and hundreds of thousands are sickened or disabled by bites. Dr. Philip Price is the science lead for Snakebite at Wellcome Trust. He spoke with my colleague, Kate Pound-Dawson, today about the new program. He explains that treating snake bites is a complex problem hampered by a lack of data, old treatments, and the natural variations in snakes.
Wellcome is launching an £80 million snake bite priority area, and that will be over the next 7 years, looking to change the way that snake bites are treated. Before he passed away, Kofi Annan was referring to snake bite as the biggest health crisis that you've probably never heard of. And one of the reasons it's relatively invisible is that it does tend to affect some of the most impoverished populations, particularly agricultural workers whose work obviously puts them in close contact with dangerous snakes. So the data that we have on snake bite is a little bit shaky, but what we know from hospital surveys and community records indicates that snake bite kills in the region of 80 to 140,000 people every year, and that's about 300 people every day. But most people don't actually die from a snake bite. Particularly the local effects can be devastating, things like tissue destruction that will lead to things like amputations and skin contractures. About 400,000 people will experience these kind of lifelong, often permanent disabilities. So the combined effect of death and disability from snake bite is actually quite staggering.
Why then has it been rather ignored for so long?
Part of it is the people who it affects are slightly invisible to the health systems. But it's important to point out that the treatments themselves that we use are quite antiquated. They're based on technology that's over 100 years old. It still relies on collecting snakes and injecting the venom into horses. So it's a dangerous treatment. It's often quite expensive to produce, and it is expensive to buy for the patients. So quite often the patients can't afford the antivenom, and so they simply don't bother showing up to the hospital. What that means is the cases are not recorded, and so the local governments themselves probably don't even know that these cases are happening. They're simply just happening in the community, out of sight and out of mind. Various different policymakers and governments need data, things like the cost effectiveness of the treatments, how many cases they're having and where those cases are happening. They need that data to be able to make the tough decisions that many governments are faced with. And when you don't have the data to back it up, it tends to get dropped down the list.
Why is there a shortage? Why is treatment so antiquated?
It's a sort of a collection of different things. The invisibility of the patients means you don't have the data. And that kind of compounds itself with the treatments that are too expensive means that the producers aren't really able to sell what they make. It's because antivenom is only as good as the snake that it's raised against. So the antivenoms that you use in the U.S. are no use in Africa. And that, from a medical product perspective, is very, very difficult because it gives you a geographical defined efficacy of your product, which then means it's already expensive to produce, and you have actually a very narrow market with which to sell it.
That was Dr. Philip Price with the Wellcome Trust in London. He was speaking with VOA's Kate Pound Dawson. Well, representatives of the Venezuelan government and the opposition are in Norway for talks on resolving the stalemate that has mired the South American nation in a political and economic crisis. Venezuelan officials say Information Minister George Rodriguez is representing President Nicolas Maduro, while lawmaker Stalin Gonzalez is leading the opposition delegation. President Maduro said Rodriguez was on a very important mission abroad during a televised speech yesterday, but did not provide any details. Well, Bob Hawke, a transformative and charismatic left-wing lawmaker with a larrikin streak who served as Australian Prime Minister from 1983 to 1991, died today at the age of 89, his family said. While others may have struggled to dismiss a reputation for boisterous, it was well-meaning behavior, silver-haired Hawke said it helped him win favor with working-class voters. Prime Minister Scott Morrison hailed Hawke's ability to speak to all Australians. In a social media post, Morrison said, "Bob Hawke was a great Australian who led and served our country with passion, courage, and an intellectual horsepower that made our country stronger." Well, you've been listening to VOA's International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and our engineer, Wojtek Zorniak. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA1, the voice of America.